brawler didn't move.
"May your name survive 1,000 years, he said, slowly and deliberately. The thief sighed. And may you die thrice over. He felt his throat tighten. He nodded to his friend. At this rate, you're going to make them change the saying. They clasped forearms. And then he was gone.
What is up, you guys? Welcome back to another episode. And not just any episode, but the last episode of Last Coliseum. Wow. I didn't think that we'd get here, but here we are. Where we last left off, Lee manages to pull Haytham back from the brink of death, and together they escape the Grey Keep. If you missed last episode or any other, I will have a link to the full playlist down in the episode description, so you can check that out there, or you can catch one of the recap videos that'll give you a sense of where we are in the story. All right, let's get down to the good stuff. I'll have a few more things to say at the end of the video, but until then, one more time, I'm Josh Call, and this is Last Coliseum. It was a full turn journey to the far side of the jaw. A single rider could do it in less, 8 or 9 days on a fast horse, but the merchant caravans never moved faster than a measured plod. More than once, she'd considered buying a nag from the caravaneers and setting off on her own, but with her growing coterie, Amatha would have had to somehow talk the merchants out of 3 horses, to say nothing of fronting the gold for the purchase. She was still amazed that she hadn't been stopped on her way out of the edge. The night she'd seen Haytham, the Greycloaks had kept her up for hours answering questions, until she was certain she'd miss the caravan entirely. Even once they'd been satisfied, they'd insisted, over Am's objections, on leaving a keeper stationed outside her door in case he came back. She'd had Berta send up a bottle of red as a thank you to the guard, then watched him through the keyhole for over an hour until his bladder was full. When he slipped out to make water, so did she. Even after she was safely on the God's Road headed east, her teeth were on edge. Every rider who passed them on the road made her stomach clench. Any one of them could have been sent by Elias to drag her back. When no one did, she was sure that he'd sent a bird ahead to Aerling, and that there'd be guards waiting for them at the gate when they arrived. She'd hidden among the sacks of beans and flour for the better part of a day until they were moving again. Her nerves eased up a bit after that, and she'd allowed herself to emerge from the wagon and even join the others around the fire at night. They'd filled the last empty bunks in Aerling, and there was a fair bit of drinking and the barter of stories among the new arrivals. Am sat and listened and kept an eye on the girl if any of the wagoners got handsy, but she avoided contributing anything to their circle. The less attention she drew, the better. Not that it was easy. Her fiddle had sat neglected in its case since she'd left. It was the longest she'd gone without playing in years. Even if they didn't recognize Moonrise, her fiddle was beautifully made and obviously expensive. She wasn't willing to risk that some unsavory wagoner might see it and decide to find out what it would fetch at a hawkshop. Only once they were east of Aerling, and neither Am nor her costly sellsword had seen any sign that Elias was coming after her, did she finally allow herself to lower her guard a little. The battered fiddle case belied its contents, and no one batted an eye at her new habit of slipping away for an hour when they made camp, just out of sight, but not so far that she couldn't yell for Hilt if she meant trouble. She laid her case on a flat rock and flipped the clasps. She'd found a secluded niche a short ways down the road overlooking the bluff. Below, the Jackson was wide and slow, meandering between the mountains. Tomorrow they'd be past the jaw, and then the wide world. She'd been this way before, she knew. She didn't remember it. She drew her instrument, but not the bow, and fingered soundlessly through a few familiar songs. It was a poor substitute for actual playing. If it wasn't already, the fiddle would be wretchedly out of tune by the time they reached Nexus, but she wasn't willing to risk being overheard from the camp. She'd received enough attention as it was, being one of the only women in the caravan. Early on, she'd noticed that she hadn't caught quite as many of the lewd jokes the wagoners were always making about the other women. She'd at first supposed that they were making them, just not while she was within earshot. It hadn't been until she was talking to one of the new wives, who'd referred to Hilt as your husband, that she realized why. She hadn't corrected the mistake. If it spared her the worst of their gawking, even more if it spared her being groped when the wagoners were in their cups, she didn't care if they thought the sellsword was the High Father himself. Her ears burned. She was all too familiar with the sensation of being stared at. She spun on her heel and glared witheringly up at the ridge above her little alcove. A few pebbles rattled down the slope as whoever it was ducked out of sight. Am's pulse quickened, her mind flashing to the worst possibility. Elias's brutes had finally caught up to drag her back. She touched the knife in her bodice to assure herself it was there and called out, "Last man I caught staring left with a broken nose." The person on the ridge didn't reply. Am counted 10 seconds, feeling more foolish by the moment, then said, less strongly, "Rowan." The girl's round face appeared above the ridge, blushing furiously. "How'd you know it was me?" "Lucky guess." It was an easy guess. She and the girl had been virtually inseparable since the caravan had set off from the edge, and not altogether by Amitha's choice. She'd met up with her sellsword that first morning, paid the fare for both of them, and been dozing in one of the wagons waiting for daybreak when she'd been roused by rough men's voices and the girl pleading for passage on the caravan. Amitha didn't want to intervene. It was no business of hers, but she sounded so pitiful. What finally moved her was hearing one of the hired men offer to front the gold for her fare. She'd just have to work it off on her back between here and Lake Mercy. It was nearly worth the crown just to see the sour look on his face when Amitha emerged from the wagon and palmed the caravaneer the coin for the girl. "Stay away from that one," she'd told the girl of the hired man between tearful thank yous. Rowan was sweet, if needy, and Am's heart had gone out to her. All the more so once she'd learned of their mutual connection in Elias Whiterose. Rowan had told the caravaneer she was 20, but Am suspected that she wasn't much older than 16. She'd been shocked to learn that the girl had no plan and no destination in mind once she was on the wagon. She had no family, none left at any rate. Her only goal was to put as many leagues between her and Whiterose as she could. Am didn't blame her. "Supper's ready," Rowan told her, climbing to her feet at the top of the ridge. "You don't want to miss it." "Thanks." She wasn't quite done with the fiddle. Rowan stood there expectantly until Amitha sighed and stowed her instrument in its case. "You never make noise with it," Rowan observed as she snapped shut the discolored brass clasps. "Are there other times you've watched me?" She didn't answer. "So, yes." "Let us get further east," Am conceded. "Then I'll give you a proper performance." "How far?" She didn't say. She passed the fiddle case up to the girl, then trudged slantways up the slope to join her on the ridge. She led the way back toward the camp. "How are your dreams? Better?"
"A bit. Not really."
"I'm sorry, Ro." She'd been doubly sorry before Erling. She'd become all too familiar with the nightmares Rowan had brought with her out of the keep. She'd showed up to the caravan with nothing. No pack, no bedroll, no extra clothes. Only the nightmares. Am had furnished her with a shirt so she wouldn't be running around in the governor's motley, and lest one of the wagoners try to bully her onto his cot, she'd let the girl squeeze onto her bunk until Am could pick up a second bedroll in Erling. She'd slept terribly. The extra heat and the breathing in her ear she could get used to, but she'd been driven nearly mad by the constant squirming and whimpering in her sleep. She'd taken to kneading a bead of candle wax into makeshift plugs for her ears, and even then, Rowan's cries still woke her at least once a night.
"I can't believe I was so stupid,"
Amitha blinked. She knew broadly what had happened to the girl since her village was sacked by desert bandits. She'd pieced it together in fragments from their conversations and Rowan's sleep mumbling, but she mummed up when Am pressed for the whole story. Whiterose was a frequent specter in Rowan's dreams. The first time she'd murmured his name in Amitha's ear, Am hadn't slept a wink for the rest of the night.
"You weren't stupid. I let myself think," she scoffed at herself. "I should have seen it."
"We all should have.
He's good at hiding what he is."
Am avoided using his name. They were almost back at the camp. The mess line snaked between the trees. Am caught Hilt's eye. He held up their stack of wooden bowls to show that he'd saved a place for them in line. She hurried to join him. Rowan caught her wrist and held her back.
"I keep seeing him,"
she muttered, not quite meeting Am's eye.
"In the dreams, I sleep too late or I get lost. And when I come back, everyone is left without me." And then he comes.
The girl nodded. She dabbed her eyes with the corner of her sleeve. Am gave her hand a reassuring squeeze.
No one is leaving without you. You hear me? Look at me. Rowan, look at me.
She did.
What do we say? He's not coming. He's not coming.
She whispered. They'd been through this before.
Louder. He's not coming.
A couple of the men at the back of the line glanced back at them.
He's not coming,
Amitha confirmed, ignoring them.
He had every chance to try and stop us before Erling, and he didn't. From this point forward, it's just you and me.
Rowan sniffed.
And Hilt. And Hilt.
She could tell that the girl was sweet on the sellsword. It had worried her at first, but so far Hilt had been the picture of slightly grumpy professionalism. He was rough and battle-hardened, but Am saw a softness in the way he handled Rowan. She wondered if he was sweet on her too.
I'll tell you what, she told the girl. You tell me when you believe it, and then I'll play for you.
She nodded to Hilt at the front of the mess line.
Now go on, before he gets to the pot.
Rowan smiled and hurried to catch up to the sellsword. Amitha hung back. The sun had set, but the clouds above the jaw still burned orange, and the trees cut the lingering daylight into ingots, with long shadows spilling across the uneven ground. Illness aside, for she'd learned early on that she didn't do well bouncing along in the wagon, there'd been a burbly, nervous feeling in her belly since they'd left the edge. Up till now, she'd kept her hair pinned back and hidden under a scarf to keep from being recognized, but once they were in Southreach and beyond, it wouldn't matter. She'd be no one. Invisible. For the first time since leaving, a small, bright hope spread warmly across her insides. Freedom. The boy was waiting for him in the carriage. The funeral had been a long affair, with mourners coming in from as far as Larkspur and Arryling to pay their respects to the late Lord Whiterose. It was unusual to wait nearly a whole turn before interring the dead, but it had taken several days even to find him. In that time, rumors raced around the city that the whole business was a fake, that Whiterose had escaped, and so on. Even after he'd been found, 5 days later, misshapen and bloated and missing his nose and fingers to the riverfish, the lowfolk continued to speculate. The service had been relatively small, with only the highborn, as well as friends and family of the dead, invited to attend, as was the custom for the nobility. Braden had taken advantage of his recently acquired barony. It had cost him a king's ransom for the privilege, and he slipped in among the mourners. It was an interesting assemblage of merchants and nobles, Braden observed. Plenty of elaborate mourning costumes, but very few tears. Elias had no family, or if he did, he'd abandoned them when he became Whiterose, and so the gathering of acquaintances and associates around his sealed casket seemed rather cold and impersonal. It was a social affair. The lords who had come were more interested in being seen grieving than on the grieving itself. What he wouldn't give to see how they behaved at his funeral. He kept an eye out for the other brethren. He'd been in meetings for days, trying to stanch the bleeding after what Haytham had done. He saw the piglet up front, clad in a black cassock. He'd traded his big golden medallion for one made of ironwood. Cat and Pentos came. They sat together a few rows ahead of him. Braden tried to catch her eye. She didn't look. He had a steep hill to climb. It wouldn't be long before Shiloh called to remove him. He'd pin the blame for Elias on Kingmaker, then try to persuade them that the damage to all of them was enough to justify his ouster. He hadn't admitted it to anyone, but Braden was worried. They couldn't remove anyone except by unanimous vote from the other merchants, and he was fairly certain that he at least still had Cat in hand, and maybe Pentos. The eldest of Lorne reliably voted against anything that his brother favored. But even if he was spared the axe, and that was hardly a guarantee, it would be difficult to maneuver in the days ahead with only 2 allies, really 1.5, out of 7. It wasn't all bad. When he'd heard that Haytham had gone and done it, he'd rolled up a sweet milk cigarette as fat as your little finger and toasted to Elias's unhappy end. In a way, it didn't change anything. It just accelerated events that were already certain. The deal he'd struck with Shiloh had only been a delay of the inevitable. They were like bucks competing for the same territory. They'd keep butting into each other until one of them caught an antler to the throat. It wouldn't be him. Not if Braden had any say. The Gray Man's machinations were arrested by the arrival of the governor. Everyone stood respectfully as the old man shuffled in on a pair of canes, flanked by six from his personal guard. Lady P. the Younger, his daughter-in-law, was on his arm, and his two grandchildren filed in behind them, their heads bowed. Braden was struck at how old the governor looked. He was nearing his 80s, and he had to be helped up onto the dais by Lady P and one of the Black Hands to pay his respects. It was a rarity to see him outside the keep ever since the supposed assassination attempt. Between that and his wife's failing health, the old man had become almost a recluse. He didn't stay long. The service had ended, and many of the mourners had trickled out before they opened the sanctuary doors to the public. Braden lingered. He was curious to see whether the lowfolk came to grieve or to gawk. He moved to one of the pews up front, timing it so that he'd intercept Cat and Pentos in the aisle. The Northmen clasped forearms and muttered something trite about being taken too soon, and Cat suffered a dry kiss on the cheek before he allowed them to pass. He'd have to do something about Cat. She'd made him swear up and down that he'd had nothing to do with Elias's death, which was not technically a lie, and she demanded an explanation for the testimonies of the house guards fingering the Reaper as the culprit. She'd done some pushing on her own and had somehow gotten her talons on a sworn statement from one of the jailers that he'd been paid to swap hay them with a double before the hanging. Braden had wasted no time in denying the charge.
"Seems a little convoluted, don't you think?"
If he wanted Elias dead, there were easier ways. He had paid to have the men in the cells swapped, he admitted. The one who'd been fitted for the hemp scarf was a milk chaser who hadn't done a damned bit of good in his entire life. The other was an up-and-comer, a family man, still green but with a bright future ahead. The Reaper game had been his idea.
Hanging him seemed like a steep price to pay for a scheme to sell a few more tickets.
As for the house guards, there was an easier explanation. When they examined the body, he hadn't been stabbed or had his throat cut. The fall had killed him. It was no secret that White Rose had been unraveling. If he killed himself, the Sirens wouldn't give him rights. The story the guards had told was meant to preserve his honor. Probably it came from the Gov himself.
What do you think, Cat? Doesn't that fit the facts just as well?
In the end, she'd been at least mollified, if not entirely satisfied. She needed allies among the Brethren just as much as he did. Still, she'd kept her distance after that. He wondered what sorts of conversations the Lady of Vice was having behind closed doors. Randall fell in next to him as he slipped through the crowd and slunk down the sanctuary steps. Only a few carriages remained of the 20 or so that had been staged in the square during the service. The sellsword put a hand on his shoulder as Braden reached for the door. He knew better than to ignore the warning. Randall was as good at spotting enemies as Braden was at collecting them. His short sword snicked from its sheath. He raised it to stab through the thin wooden siding with its patterned holes. He opened the door. The boy was sitting neatly in the carriage, his hands clasped in front of him, his face freckled with light from the holes. He looked at each of them in turn.
"Braden."
"Randall?"
"Boy,"
the gray man acknowledged. He nodded to the sellsword, who, perhaps slightly begrudgingly, stowed his blade. Kingmaker climbed in on one side of the carriage while Randall squeezed in next to Lee.
"I hope you're not expecting a ride somewhere,"
Braden said as the carriage jerked into motion.
"How's the funeral?"
"No surprises. How's our friend?"
Lee didn't answer.
"That makes 3 times I've saved his life,"
the gray man remarked, counting them on his fingers.
"I fear he's made a habit of it."
No answer.
"You never answered my letter."
"He's mending. Slowly. That file you sent for the pain, it helps."
"Be careful with that,"
Braden nodded.
"It'll be trouble if he gets a taste for it. 2 drops should do it. 3 if it's bad."
He studied the boy for a minute before he spoke again.
"Have you given any thought to my offer?"
A muscle in Lee's jaw twitched.
"It's a big opportunity for you.
If you're trying to get rid of me,
there's easier ways to get rid of you,"
he said with a sidelong glance at the sellsword.
Not that Brayden hadn't considered it. The easiest thing would have been to snip the threads of the thief and the brawler, no more worrying about who said what to whom. But besides the element of sentimentality, it felt like a waste to have invested so much over the years into keeping Hatham alive, only to smother him with a pillow in his sickbed. He didn't doubt that the thief had taken steps to protect himself. Somewhere there was surely a written confession detailing the Grey Man's involvement in their crimes. If Lee stopped breathing, it would be an easy thing to ensure that it ended up in the hands of the Keepers. It was clever. It's what Brayden would have done.
"You've impressed me," he told the boy. "You've proven resourceful. You're obviously talented. I'm in the business of cultivating talent. It's as simple as that."
"My whole life is here."
"What, Pam? What else?"
Lee didn't say.
"Larkspur is a 3-day ride from here. You can still visit the old girl. You can still send her gold. You'll make a damn sight more than you would pinching pennies in the coppers."
"I'd do fine."
He sounded slightly indignant. Kingmaker shrugged.
"I can't force you. It'll be hard work, at least at the start, and it won't be glamorous. But you'll be helping to build something. That's what all this is."
He motioned to the carriage, the city, the earth, and sky.
"It's my legacy." He leaned forward. "What'll be your legacy, boy? Think about it."
Lee looked out through the holes at the street sliding by.
"I'll keep that in mind."
"I mean it. You can't leave Harbor moored to the past. I said the same thing to Hatham when he was about your age."
It was quiet for a moment.
"Do you know why the first men smashed up their longboats when they reached the continent? So that they couldn't turn back. There's only one way out, forward and through fire."
The thief stared at him. Brayden smirked.
"What? I said it's the only way. I didn't say you'd like it."
He dumped the boy out of the carriage shortly after. They were at the verge between the Golden Quarter and the Silvers. The old girl's wasn't far from here. Lee blinked at the mid-morning bright as Randall climbed back into the carriage and closed the door.
"I'll think about it," he said, loud enough to be heard over the street chatter.
"Don't think too long," Kingmaker warned him through the door. "Moments like these are like lightning strikes. Blink and you'll miss it."
He snapped his fingers, and the carriage rattled on before the thief could reply. He watched the boy through the siding. Lee stood there in the street, staring after the retreating carriage getting smaller and smaller until the street bustle hid them from view.
Lee was tired.
The past turn had been a flurry of activity, tending to Hatham, fetching supplies for Paul, endless meetings with the spider, constantly looking over his shoulder for fear that the keepers were bearing down on him. He'd never been much for coffee, but these days he drank it by the bucketful. It probably wasn't helping the paranoia any. His shadow was long and jagged as he climbed the steps of Paul's. The new place was bigger. It was clean and well-built, and you could go up and down the stairs without fearing you'd fall right through them. But there was something missing. Something that the old place had had in her split boards and her faded paint. Something besides termites. He remembered dragging the brawler up the steps, almost delirious with exhaustion. It took him a day before it really set in that what had happened, the soldiers, the rope, the spice, the horses, the guard, actually had. He knew that there was a conversation coming with Paul, if not about the crossbow quarrel sticking out of Hatham's side, then at least about the stolen plate armor he'd been wearing over it. But so far, Lee had managed to avoid her. The only time she directly addressed it was after she'd changed the brawler's bandages and stitched him up. Hatham had been sleeping peacefully. She'd drugged him heavily before taking the needle to his face. She'd stowed the catgut and rinsed the blood off her hands and said quietly without looking at Lee,
"Promise me you haven't made me a criminal. He's a good man," was all the thief could say.
The old woman was a stern and unrelenting overseer of Hatham's recovery. She hadn't even let Lee see the brawler until the past few days. After their hike through filth, they'd both developed a fever over the days that followed, and Paul refused to let the thief into his sick room until she was sure that Lee wouldn't make it worse. By the time Lee's fever had subsided and he was no longer
drinking water, Hayden was awake and talking. He'd even begun walking around, assisted by a cane, though Paul kept him mostly confined to his sickbed. Even with his illness, Lee had kept himself busy in between bouts of squatting over a bucket. If he slowed down, he'd have to contend with what he'd seen, what he'd done, up there in the wood. The jerk of the toy crossbow in his hands, the crunch of the guard's body through the leaves, the way he'd still been twitching when Lee shoveled dead leaves on top of the body and ran back to the lift. He couldn't tell Paul what he'd done. With the old woman's constant clucking over Hatham, he hadn't had the chance to tell the brawler. The only person he'd been able to confide in had been the spider. Kingmaker had congratulated him and poured him another finger of alder whiskey. "No one's life is worth more than your own, boy. Remember that. No man has ever achieved anything worth anything without climbing over a hill of bodies." His voice was nasally from the broken nose. Lee hadn't asked what he meant. The door to the sick room was open. Paul was out, but a few of the younger boys were throwing marbles in the room downstairs. The brawler was on his feet and dressed. The canvas knapsack he'd asked Lee to buy was sitting on the corner of his cot. Lee knocked on the doorframe as Hatham was stuffing his bundle of clothes into the knapsack. "Going somewhere?" He glanced around the room and saw that the bedside table with the dressings and bottles and the gray man's file had been cleared. "You're leaving." The brawler snapped the clasp closed and turned to the thief. The crescent gash on his face was like a black centipede. It began at the middle of his forehead and bisected the old lightning stripe at the bridge of his nose before curving just under his right cheekbone. It had taken some practice for Lee not to wince when he looked at him.
"How was the funeral?"
"I didn't go inside." "You're leaving," he repeated, glancing down the hall in case the old woman had stolen up the stairs unnoticed. "Have you told Paul?"
"I was hoping you could do that."
Lee grimaced, remembering the first and last time the brawler had told Paul about his intention to leave as soon as he was able. She'd insisted, in spite of his objections, that he stay where she could continue to monitor his recovery. Lee half thought that she'd try and drug him again to keep him from escaping.
"Sure, leave me to take the slings and arrows," Lee winced. "Are you sure you're up for it? You still have a long way to go before you're healed up."
"I've imposed on you all long enough."
Paul had been sleeping in her armchair downstairs ever since turning her bedroom into the brawler's makeshift sickbay.
"You know what she would say to that. I think if she ever stopped having cuts and scrapes to bind up, she'd go mad."
Hatham didn't answer. With the butt of his cane, he hooked his boots from under the little end table and dragged him over to where he was sitting on the corner of the bed. His ankles were still swathed in foul-smelling bandages after the shackles had chafed them raw. He was having trouble squeezing into his boots. Lee knelt down in front of him and loosened the laces before fitting them carefully around the brawler's swollen feet. Hatham resisted, but with his injured side, he could barely hunch over to tie them. After struggling for a minute, he yielded to his friend's help.
"Do you know where you'll go?"
asked the thief, looking up from the brawler's feet. Hatham didn't say.
"Your monastery," he nodded.
"Or the plains down south."
"Have you been there?"
Hatham shrugged. Mummers sometimes came through with legends about the untamed blood plains. Story was that during the conquest of the continent, whole companies of soldiers had been swallowed up by the long grass and never heard from again.
"I thought there's nothing but savages down there."
The brawler bared his teeth.
"I'll fit right in then," Lee laughed.
Hatham didn't. He eased himself to his feet with the cane and took a long look out the small window at the street below.
"There's nothing for me up here," he said under his breath.
You could go after Amatha," Lee offered. "I asked the spider to look into it."
Hatham's nostrils flared. His knuckles were white around the head of the cane. He glared out the window. Lee steeled himself.
"She's on a caravan headed east. You could..."
"Drop it, Lee."
He did.
He'd tried broaching the topic of the fiddler more than once since Hatham had woken up. He was always met with a wall of stony silence. Lee knew from the spider that she had left the edge the morning after the execution. He didn't blame her. When Hatham had voiced his intention to leave as soon as he was strong enough to travel, Lee had assumed he meant to catch up to her. So much for all that. Lee didn't speak again until the silence became unbearable.
"He wants me to come work for him."
A muscle in Hatham's jaw twitched. Says he needs someone who can be his eyes and ears in Larkspur. He waited for a response. It's a big opportunity.
What do you want me to say?
I don't know. He threw up his hands. I need advice. You worked with him before. Do you think I should do it?
After all that had happened between them, he suspected he already knew the answer. Hatham was quiet for a moment.
Whatever a man builds, he owns. I can't say no for you. Kingmaker can give you what you want.
He looked back at the thief, his face grim.
But then he'll own you. You have to be okay with that.
Lee nodded. He wasn't sure he knew what he wanted anymore. Were you?
I was. Until I wasn't.
He took one last look out the window and sighed.
It's time.
He took his cloak off the hook on the back of the door, wincing as he slipped his arms through the sleeves. Lee had split their take from the keep, White Rose's purse plus what Gus had given him for the plate armor at the hawk shop, and out of Hatham's half he'd bought more bandages and supplies, the cloak and a few odds and ends to supplement the rest of his effects. Out of his own half he'd bought a headscarf of the kind the merchants wore to keep the sun off down on the hardpan. Even with Red Ugly presumed dead, his injuries would invite unwanted attention on his way through the gate. It would be just their bloody luck if after everything the brawler got nicked by the gray cloaks on his way out of the city. Hatham drew the headscarf from his knapsack and wound it loosely around his face. He nodded to Lee, arms akimbo.
How do I look?
Like a ponce, he grinned. I'll try and hold Paul off, but if you're still cityside in an hour, don't be surprised if she marches down to the gate to drag you back.
I'll be ready,
Hatham replied.
Name survive, Lee.
Lee followed him to the door.
I'll be seeing you, brother.
The brawler paused.
Name survive.
Lee couldn't see his expression under the headscarf, but he felt his eyes on him, waiting for the counterphrase. The old wanderer's farewell was only given when you didn't know when or if you'd see someone again. To refuse the reply was a tacit denial that this might be their last goodbye.
Say it,
Hatham insisted. Lee bristled.
You're not gonna jump in the river, right? So I'll see you.
He held out a hand.
If you are, you can give me back the rest of that coin.
The brawler didn't move.
May your name survive 1,000 years,
he said, slowly and deliberately. The thief sighed.
And may you die thrice over.
He felt his throat tighten. He nodded to his friend.
At this rate, you're gonna make them change the saying.
They clasped forearms. And then he was gone. Lee would catch hell from Paul when she came back from her errands and found her patient's bed empty. Empty of the brawler, anyway. But that was a problem for later. Lee stood in the window until he caught sight of his friend on the street and continued to watch him until he disappeared into the featureless mass of bodies further down. He half thought Hatham would look back and see him watching from the window. He didn't. It was only once the brawler had disappeared that exhaustion finally took him. He barely made it over to the cot before collapsing. When Paul came in later to check on her patient, she'd find the thief snoring, still in his boots. If he could have held off sleep a little while longer, he might have heard it. There. Under the rumble of street chatter outside, behind the staccato clatter of the boys throwing marbles downstairs, it was a sound like shadow, the echo of an echo of an echo. Or maybe it was a notable lack of sound, the sort of stillness that warned of a gathering storm, the caesura in a chorus of crickets after a loud noise. It was the sound of threads being unspooled and stretched across the shears of fate, taut enough to break just by looking. It was the sound of looming death, of unknown futures and numbered days. It was the sound of the dark. He almost heard it. Almost. But he was tired, and the cotward pull of sleep was strong and welcome. He'd snore right through supper, and wouldn't wake until hunger roused him late into the night after Paul and the boys were all fast asleep. And for the first time in a long time, he didn't dream.
Hey, This is usually the part of the video where I tell you to hit the subscribe and leave a like or a comment or a 5-star review or whatever. And you should still totally do that, by the way. But I figured that since this is the last episode of Last Coliseum, I figured that I would take a little extra time and just say thank you and just kind of share my heart a little bit about this story and the process behind it. So I started writing Last Coliseum under a different title, a worse title, back in 2014. I was a senior in high school and I had all of this artistic, creative energy to get out and no money. And so I figured what I could do is type on a word processor and just do art that way. And at the time, I had this Dungeons & Dragons character who I had created for a game that one of my friends was going to run that didn't end up happening. And so I had this whole backstory created for this character that was just going to go to waste. And so that summer, I started working on this story. And the way that I had always envisioned it was that it's the Count of Monte Cristo set in the world of Game of Thrones. And the first draft of the story took me 18 months. I was a sophomore in college when I finished it. And I remember going back to the beginning to read it. And I thought, this is terrible. Just like absolute dog water. And it really upset me because I had just spent 18 months and hours and hours and hours all through the beginning of college working on this project. And I started to get later toward the end of the draft and I realized, oh, there's actually a couple things that are kind of redeemable here. And so I spent the next 2.5 years rewriting it and it was still terrible. And then I spent a couple more years rewriting it and a couple more years rewriting it. And ultimately the final draft of Last Coliseum, or I guess I should say the shooting draft of this manuscript was finished in February of 2023. So fully 9.5 years after I started working on this. And in that time, my life has just changed tremendously. The place of art in my life has changed tremendously. And even with that, I've been super grateful for this story. It has fundamentally shaped the way that I think and the way that I speak and the way that I write, obviously. And that's why I decided that when I finished this story, even though I had sort of put on the shelf the idea of wanting to go and try and publish this, not to mention that the manuscript was 230,000 words long, so like 750 pages. For if you are a writer, that is way too long for a first novel, to be clear. And so even though I had kind of put to bed the idea of publishing it, at least at this point, I decided that what I wanted to do in light of just how formative this story has been for me throughout time, I wanted to put it out as a podcast and as a YouTube video because it felt like that was a more accessible medium for my friends and my loved ones and just anybody who wanted to check out the story. So it has been at this point about 1.5 years. And by the time this episode posts, it'll be close to 2 years from the time when I finished the story and began this process of working on the podcast, and well over 1 year that I have been posting. It has been a ton of work. It has been very hard for me at times. And there have been a ton of people who have come around me and just encouraged me throughout this whole process to keep going and who have been following the story from the beginning. So for that, I just am super grateful for my friends who have been following this story and encouraging me from the beginning. Willoughby, Drew, JR, Ava, Matt and Emily. There's probably a bunch of other people whose names I am forgetting right now. But from the bottom of my heart, I would not be at this point of having finished this whole thing were it not for you guys. So thank you. If you are somebody who somehow you found this story and I don't know who you are, but you just stumbled across this, and I guess there are a few of you because I can see on the RSS feed analytics that there's people in other countries who are following this story. I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you guys so much. It has been an absolute privilege to be able to share not just this story, but to share this piece of my heart and myself with you guys. So I'm incredibly grateful for that. I would love to hear from you either if you want to leave a comment on the video or a review. That sounds very self-serving. But even if you want to reach out to me on Instagram or something like that, I would love to hear what your thoughts are on this story. All right, I have rambled long enough. Thank you, thank you, thank you if you have been following this story from the beginning or if you're just catching it now. So for the very last time, this is me signing off. I'm Josh Call, and this is Last Coliseum.